Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast. This is Joy Mason-Intriago, Managing Director of the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. We are the only professional association that combines all aspects of data and cyber governance for the governance, risk, and compliance professional. You can find us online at adcg.org. It gives us great pleasure to host this event led by two outstanding moderators, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. Jerry is a founder of Buckley LLP, a national financial services law firm based in Washington, D.C. Prior to entering private practice, he served as minority staff director of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Jody is CEO of Global Cyber Risk LLC and chairs the American Bar Association's Privacy and Computer Crime Committee. We have some really great guests lined up today and in the future, so please be sure to rate us and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry Buckley. Today's episode of our National Privacy Legislation Podcast features Mark Rash, an adjunct professor at George Washington University Law School. Mark has been a chief privacy officer, and earlier in his career, he was with the U.S. Department of Justice, where he led the department's efforts to investigate and prosecute cyber and high technology crime, and founded the Computer Crime Unit within the Criminal Division's Fraud Section, which eventually led to the creation of the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section of the Criminal Division, affectionately known as CSIPS. In our previous podcasts, most of our guests agree that a private right of action will be one of the key issues in any national privacy legislation. We have not yet, however, had a more in-depth discussion on the topic of private right of action and how that might be received in courts. Mark, I know you have a lot to say about this topic, and I hope that we can highlight some of the key issues or obstacles around private suits over privacy breaches in this discussion. Let's open by asking you to share your thoughts with respect to the California Consumer Protection Act, the CCPA, and its private right of action, since it sort of lit the fuse on this topic.
Sure. And thank you, Jerry, and thank you, Jody, for having me here today. So the CCPA is interesting because it represents a number of things. Number one, when it comes to comprehensive data privacy legislation, it represents this trend of going state by state instead of having a national privacy law. And that has a lot of consequences. It means that you're going to have enclaves where you're going to have high rights of privacy and lower rights of privacy. You're going to see litigation happening in one state and not another state. And particularly when you provide some degree of a private right of action in one state, what ends up happening is because the internet is multi-state, multi-jurisdictional, it's not that people in Indiana can't sue and people in California can. It's that people in Indiana sue, but they sue in California, or they become the beneficiary of a class action. So whatever gives the greatest right to sue becomes where those lawsuits are filed. And then it becomes necessary for the defendants to winnow all of this out. Now, what's interesting about the private right of action in CCPA is that there is not an automatic private right of action under CCPA. What you have to do, and this is consistent with the way things are structured in GDPR and European law, is you have to bring your complaint first to some government agency, which will then evaluate it and determine whether or not you can sue. So this is very similar to the way we do it in the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, if you believe that you've been the victim of discrimination. You go in and you ask for a right to sue. It's very similar to what the way the policy decision made by the state legislature in passing the CCPA. You actually have to ask permission. And what that means is that the Attorney General's Office of California acts as sort of a block to the ability of people to have their day in court. And so they get to decide first whether they believe the case has merit, whether they want to proceed, and only if they decide that it has merit, but they don't want to proceed, do you get a private right of action under CCPA.
Well, that's really interesting. I liked what you said about the people in Indiana go to California and sue. I hadn't thought about it that way before, but you're right, with all of these class actions, that it's exactly what happens. So that was State Act. Let's turn to the Privacy Act of 1974. It has a private right of action. As you know, it only applies to the federal government. But might this help guide such a provision in a national privacy bill?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the Privacy Act, because the Privacy Act really is the great grandfather of almost all statutory privacy rights that we have in the United States. You know, there's a long tradition of common law privacy rights, right of intrusion against seclusion, intrusion in seclusion, or common law defamation rights, or false light and all that. But the Privacy Act actually represents one of the very early pieces of legislation where the federal government, it's a result of the Nixon administration's abuse of private data by the government, that we created this idea that there's a private right of action for people to sue based upon the government leaking of their information, their personal information. So it really is one of the oldest statutory privacy rights, and it dates back to the mid-70s. It is a decent model for a private right of action, but the idea that the government should be liable for releasing information about people with evil intent, creating liability for companies that suffer data breaches, is a stretch. If a company collects personal information promising not to disclose it and then breaches its own privacy policy and sells it or gives it away, you already have a private right of action for breach of contract, breach of express promise, breach of implied promise, or in the nature of certain kinds of information, you may have intentional or negligent or reckless infliction of emotional distress. So if I'm a hospital and I release information about your mental health, not only would you have a cause of action or a HIPAA violation, but you'd also have a private right of action for breach of an implied promise of confidentiality. So there's been lots of ways that people have been able to get their privacy rights litigated in the courts. But what they don't have is they don't have a statutorily recognized right to privacy. And that becomes important when it comes down to issues like standing and damages, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So a comprehensive law like the Privacy Act, but that deals with private sector holding of personal information and either the negligent or willful release of it in a private right of action, would go a long way towards curbing abuses of privacy.
Because it would be a statutory right to privacy.
It would define what it is that companies can and cannot do. One of the big differences between the United States and Europe in terms of privacy law philosophically is that Europe basically says privacy is a fundamental right. And while you're allowed to collect personal information about people, it has to be for a stated purpose. So if I'm collecting your driver's license information, it's got to be because I want you to drive somewhere. Or if I'm collecting your bank account information, it's because I'm the bank or doing something for the bank. Any use outside of the use for which it was expressly collected is considered to be a dubious use of that information that has to be justified. In the United States, it works exactly the opposite. Once I have your information, there's pretty much a presumption I can do anything I want with it. I can sell it, I can give it away, and the like. And we rely much more heavily in the United States on the concept of consent. If you've consented to allowing me to use it in a particular way, I can do so. The problem is we get consent by having this privacy policy that's 20 pages long, written in legalese that nobody reads. And we say, well, don't you see on paragraph 27C14 subset A, you agreed to allow me to do this?
Yeah.
And it's a fundamentally different way of looking at privacy between the United States and Europe. The CCPA is a first step towards taking that European model and applying it in the United States.
Well, I want to turn this over to Jerry, but first I just want to make note, and we don't have to discuss it, I just want to make note that Senator Brian Schatz on March 23 introduced the Data Care Act, which is co-sponsored by 17 senators. on protecting people's personal data online, and it would require websites, apps, and other online providers to take responsible steps to safeguard their information and stop misuse. And it has a duty of care, a duty of loyalty, a duty of confidentiality in federal and state enforcement. So at least people are starting to think about, as you're talking about, a statutory right. Jerry, over to you.
Well, thank you, Jody. And thank you, Mark. It's great to have you with us today. I wanted to make one observation on your earlier comment, and get your thought on that. That is, even though there are common law rights, the CCPA and, of course, GDPR, which has some applicability and reach in the United States, create rights, the right to correct, the right to require deletion. Those rights have not been recognized in common law. So is it fair to say that the private right of action created by statute relates to the rights created by that statute? And in both the GDPR in Europe and in the United States, there is some filter through a governmental body. Don't you think that it's because the statute creates new rights that it also provides a private right of action?
Partially, yes. The private right of action typically comes up for a breach of a statutory obligation. The statute says, you must do this, you may not do that, and if you violate this statute, you can be sued in state court or federal court for violating the statute. Your private right of action for a common law right just comes from the common law. And there's three things to look at also. One is common law privacy, common law data privacy, and then statutory privacy rights. So when we look at the common law privacy, it is much broader and much more different in character than what we think of as modern data privacy. So when we think about common law privacy, it is the right to be left alone, the right to be free from government intrusion. It's much more of a freedom than it is a right to data privacy. That started changing with statutes like the best model for a data privacy statute is actually the Fair Credit Reporting Act. So the Fair Credit Reporting Act is where Congress comes in and says, we got these things called credit reports. And it's a bunch of really sensitive information about people, what they bought, where they shop, where they bank. We recognize that those things are useful in employment decisions and loan decisions, but we're going to allow that stuff to be collected and sold and used. But it has to be accurate. The consumer has to have a right to see it. The consumer has to have a right to correct it. The consumer has a right to know when it's being used and accessed and for what purposes. And it can only be used for certain purposes and not other purposes. So the Fair Credit Reporting Act, fundamentally and philosophically, is the first statute that deals with those concepts of data collection, data use, data accuracy, data access that become the fundamental principles for data privacy today, statutory data privacy. If we were really serious about enforcing rights to privacy, whether statutory or otherwise, we would reduce the barriers to litigation for enforcing them. So think about this. You know, you learn of a data breach. You get an email from a hospital, from a credit card company that says, your data has been breached. Okay, please enjoy this $10 coupon, or if you want to, you can sign up for fraud monitoring. We'll pay for it. Most people get those alerts and they feel uneasy and queasy, but they throw them away. You know, 4 or 5% of people even sign up for the credit reporting anymore because there's breach overload. Don't excuse that for saying that people don't care about privacy. All right, and the problem is, any other remedy for a breach of privacy is just too hard for them to do. Nobody gets a data breach notification and saying, oh, by the way, your credit card number has been compromised. Call your credit card company and report it and get a new credit card. And immediately says, I'm going to my lawyer and I'm going to sue. Because his lawyer is going to say, what are you going to sue for? It's not worth my time and energy to sue for some future harm, something like that. So most privacy breaches result in no remedy, no lawsuit, nothing happening. And so if you really wanted to encourage, use litigation as a means of compensating people for breaches of privacy and deterring future breaches, you would make the person responsible for the breach also liable for attorney's fees, costs, class actions, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, just to, you know, to spend a little time on Fair Credit Reporting Act and how it's been implemented, where the FTC and now the CFPB have responsibility there, what role do you think private litigants should have?
Well, so there are advantages and disadvantages to private litigation, and there is advantages and disadvantages to government litigation. The advantage of a private course of action, a private right of action, is that they will be much more frequent because any lawyer who thinks he can make money for himself or herself or for their client, particularly in class action, will be inclined to bring a lawsuit, particularly about against large companies. So there is no barrier to enforcement. If something happens and it causes harm, there can be enforcement. You don't have to take it to an agency that says, we don't have enough time or energy or resources. As long as you can get a lawyer or even a pro se litigant interested, you have access to the courts. So that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing because there's no mechanism, no quick and efficient mechanism for weeding out frivolous lawsuits or lawsuits that make frivolous claims, including frivolous damage awards. So that's an advantage or disadvantage of a private right of action. But even a private right of action imposes a huge cost on the litigants, whether it's the plaintiff or the defendant. So oftentimes we'll just use an attorney general and say, look, I'm just going to file a complaint with the attorney general, let the AG's office do the investigation, gather the evidence, collect the data, and let them take care of it. And when they're done, let them punish the bad guy. But that goes to the question of what do we want to do? Do we want to punish people who violate privacy? Or do we want to compensate people who are injured as a result of a violation of privacy? And that's a philosophical question, particularly when it comes to privacy rights, where it's really hard to quantify someone's damages, which is something the courts have been struggling with.
That's where you put your finger on the real issue regarding how have the cases that have gone forward fared?
So there have been a number of things. There have been a lot of cases that have involved privacy violations. And these privacy violations come in two broad categories. The first category is the failure to protect. That's the data breach cases. I've collected a bunch of personal information. I've either had a statutory or some other common law or contractual obligation to protect it. I failed to protect it. Hackers stole the information. The personal information got out there. I'm liable. That's more of a negligence theory or a recklessness theory or a breach of contract theory. But in those cases, the lawsuits do not necessarily allege that the person who collected the data misused it, just that they failed to protect it. So one broad category is the negligent or reckless failure to protect private information.
And the measure of damages in those cases?
Well, again, those tend to be compensatory. In other words, if I can prove that I suffered some harm from the release of the data, as a general rule, I get compensated for the harm that I can prove. But here's the problem with that. Let's assume that a hospital negligently fails to protect the records about my gallbladder surgery. So now the entire world knows about my gallbladder surgery, my medical history, my allergies to drugs, and all that. And I go to a lawyer and I say, I want to sue for damages. And the lawyer says, okay, let's pick a number. What are your demonstrable, provable harm and damages resulting from the fact that now the world knows about your gallbladder surgery? And I say, well, they breached a duty. It says, okay, agreed. But what's your harm? And we have a tendency, both in the courts and in the judicial system, meaning the lawyers and the like, to say, okay, well, did you lose your job? No. Were you embarrassed and not able to join a club or something like that? No. Were you discriminated against getting insurance? No. Well, just people treat me funny. Okay, well, what's the dollar value of people treat me funny? that kind of stuff. So the problem with privacy philosophically is that it is hard in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, to put a dollar value on the loss of privacy. And that goes back to the common law, you know, the idea that if somebody's hanging out the window and watching you get undressed, it's one thing to throw them in jail for being a peeping Tom. But if you want to sue them for damages, what damages, what number can you come up with? You can try to say things like pain and suffering and emotional distress, but you still have to prove actual, tangible harm. So the courts have been struggling and using two different concepts to try to deny plaintiffs in these cases any kind of recovery. The first one is standing to sue. They basically have been arguing that the theory that you might suffer some harm in the future is too tenuous to allow you to sue. So if you had a data breach and they got your name and your address and your social security number and your credit card numbers and your place of birth, and it's all out there on the dark web as a result of some merchant not protecting your data, you say, well, look, I'm worried about identity fraud. I now have to take these measures to protect myself against identity fraud. In many of these cases, the courts are saying fear of future harm is too speculative to constitute current harm, and therefore you can't sue. So that's the first way they kick you out of court, on the issue of standing. And the Supreme Court last week, actually in an 8-1 decision, on a related issue, and that is damages or harm, said that nominal damages, $1, were sufficient to establish standing in court. I don't know how that's going to play out in the privacy realm, but it might help. The second is the issue of damages. So the first one is standing. Do you have a concrete harm that allows you to sue in court? And again, the courts have been kicking cases out on standing. And the second one is, even if you can demonstrate that you have some concrete harm, can you sufficiently quantify that harm to a dollar value to allow a court or a jury to award you some monetary compensation? And again, if you can't show a loss of a job or social ostracization or something like that, the court may just award you some nominal amount of damages. As a result, filing a lawsuit may be good for a class, but not good for the individuals in the class.
Well, so, you know, there's a way legislators can fix all that you just talked about. So they could say, okay, if this occurs, it's a statutory harm.
That's correct.
And if this occurs, here's a statutory damages. Maybe it's $1,000 per occurrence. And maybe somebody has more than $1,000 damages. Maybe they have less. But we're not going to do that. We're just going to say, for everybody that this happens to, they get $1,000. And that is going to be enough to push better behavior.
Absolutely.
The market.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head. So if legislatures really want to push privacy along and use the litigation system as opposed to the regulatory system, okay, to do so, it could do what it's done in relation to other privacy. For example, lots of states, Maryland is one of them, makes it illegal to tape somebody without their consent. It's the interception statute.
The two-party consent.
Two-party consent. Or the all-party consent, as it is in Maryland. The thing in federal law makes it illegal to tape somebody without anybody's consent, but it doesn't provide for statutory damages. In Maryland, each time you make such a recording, the damages are either $1,000 or the actual harm, whichever is higher, which means that a company that had a policy of illegally recording Maryland residents may find that it recorded hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people over the course of months or years, and the damages and fines may be in the tens of thousands or millions of dollars. So one lawsuit, one class action lawsuit, statutory damages, boom. But before you start saying, well, statutory damages are going to be terrible for companies, the answer to that is also no. If I'm asked to process medical records for 10,000 people, and I know that the statutory damages, if I have a breach of the records, are $1,000 each, I can now know what the cost of not providing security is.
Yeah.
I can say, the most it will cost me, likely, the most, putting aside actual damages, but the most it will likely cost me will be $1,000 per record, 100,000 records, $10 million. The likelihood that I'll have a breach of all of those records will be 2%. That allows me to actually weigh privacy and security into my cost of doing business and build it in. And it means for security vendors, they get to say, if I can reduce your risk by 5%, that will save you this amount of money.
Yeah, well, it also helps them understand adequate insurance coverage limits.
That's exactly right. If you don't have a value to a breach, you can't have a value to avoiding the breach.
So what do you think is a driver behind this call for a private right of action? Is it the number of data breaches and consumers that are frustrated with identity theft and cleaning up after the breach? Or is it the reluctance of courts to recognize there's been harm and allow cases to proceed? Or is it the urging of the plaintiff's bar?
I think it's all of those. And I think it's one more. You know, there are a couple of other things too. Part of the problem is that in the absence of a private right of action, you rely on regulatory action. Regulatory action requires some attorney general to decide to go after somebody or some consumer protection agency to go after them. And they prioritize. And your case may not be their priority. And they won't take it. And you can't force them to do it. And so what ends up happening is that in states where a particular company or an industry has captured the regulators because it's a critically important industry, there's no way that a regulator is going to go after that critically important industry. That's number one. There's a subtle corruption there. The second one is one of resources. If the agency doesn't have the resources to do it, they're not going to do it. And the other thing is, when I talk about resources, they have the same attorney general that's responsible for consumer protection is also responsible for prisoners' legal rights and environmental protection and enforcing state contract law and, you know, defending election fraud and enforcing state mask mandates. So yours is not the 100th most important thing to them. And the final one is what I brought up before, is that to attorneys general, these are fines to be imposed upon entities and collected to the state government. That doesn't help the victims one whit.
No, I know.
And so the purpose of a private right of action is intended to be mostly compensatory to victims, to say, if you breach your agreement, you have to make them whole.
You know, I just want to observe, though, as someone who represents many of the private sector players who have large amounts of data in the financial services space, it is true that among the drivers for private right of action is the class action bar. And as we know, they are a major funder of the Democratic Party, and they are often work very closely with consumer activists. Now, I'm not saying that they that there's anything wrong with that at all, but I am observing that there is a significant economic interest that is driving this effort for.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I believe, Jerry, I mean, absolutely, that in a class action lawsuit, the winners in a class action lawsuit are the named plaintiffs and their counsel. The losers are the companies that are sued. And the next group of losers are the ordinary people. Now, look, I mean, I've gotten the postcards in the mail saying, you know, hey, you use this product. You're entitled to $5. That's great because it's $5 I didn't have and I didn't have to do anything about it, right? That's nice. And the other thing that
is made, of course, is that while the $5 means very little to the members of the class, the supposedly, and I scratch my head on this, the enforcement of the law that is brought about by the availability of the class is something that deters bad behavior. But, you know, if you look at it, look at the breaches that occur. Companies are not choosing to put their, they are in some instances trying to use the data that they're entrusted with, and we can deal with all of that, which is part of the new legislation.
Sure.
But with respect to breaches, often those are the result of state actors, criminals, yeah. others getting data. And here's the fact that our cyber police have not been able to protect us.
Sure. And you know there's carrot and stick here.
I'm walking down the street with a bag of money that I'm supposed to deliver to my client. And somebody hits me over the head and steals the bag, and then I get sued for a breach. I mean,
yeah, there's a tremendous amount of this blaming the victims. We name the data breaches in the names of the companies that were the victims of the breaches. This is the target data breach, yeah. the Home Depot, and oftentimes and almost invariably they've done something wrong. Okay, they've been negligent because you can't. You know, there's two kinds of companies, those who know that they've had a data breach and those who've had a data breach but don't know it, right?
Exactly.
And there is this huge tendency to blame the victims and certainly to sue the victims. And part of the way we do negligence law, both in malpractice and all that, is we look at something that happened and we say, if you had only done this, you would have prevented it from happening. It's not that expensive or hard to do this. Therefore, you were negligent in failing to do that. The problem is the company doesn't just have to do this or that. They have to do everything at all times. So we may have gotten to the point where it is so difficult and expensive to do everything right that data breaches have become inevitable. And the other thing you pointed out as well is, you can do everything right against a normal data breach and still have a breach as a result of a state actor.
And
nobody blamed the World Trade Center for not being able to withstand two jets flying into it. Wasn't designed for that.
Yeah. I think what we're all exploring here, and it's a very useful discussion, Mark, because it's not something that we have really spent time on. And I think that the complexity of the private right of action, all people say is, well, there are two major hurdles to national legislation, preemption and private right of action. But exploring in more depth, then we can go further, of course, what really is the private right of action issue and what is the appropriate use of a private right of action? Let us look back at what the Europeans, you referenced in the GDPR, what they've done, and they've only done it relatively recently, but how effective is their approach, which of course relies on a governmental gatekeeper, but then lets nonprofits bring actions? Can you explain a little bit about that and what you think its likely success will be?
Well, the primary enforcement mechanism is regulatory for the GDPR. Its primary yes. objective is to achieve compliance and not compensation. One of the things that a criticism of the lack of a private right of action, I believe there should be a private right of action for intentional acts. Okay? So if I have a privacy policy and I say, I will not sell your data, and then I sell your data, that's not a negligence theory. That's a fraud, deceptive practices, not in the way that we use it in the United States, like you promised you'd keep it secure and you didn't. I'm talking about outright deceit. Those are right. fraud cases. You should be able to sue for fraud. The cases, those have much greater degree of culpability, individual blame, maliciousness, right? And we shouldn't have to wait that they should be subject to regulatory action, but we shouldn't have to wait for that. On the other hand, with mere negligence, and I don't mean to minimize negligence because sometimes you have gross negligence. Some companies are doing a lot, but not everything. Some places are doing most things, but not well. Some companies are taking in personal data and not doing a damn thing. So there's a whole scope of them. But the model in Europe is generally a regulatory model. And frankly, for the first several years of the GDPR, we're still in the first several years of the GDPR, the goal and objective, and there have been a number of high-profile enforcement actions, but it is still their objective to achieve compliance. And if the cops come in and they kick in the door and say, we're here to arrest you, is a lot different than it says, you've had a data breach, you kick in the door, we're here to help you prevent it. And unfortunately, governments serve both of those functions. Mm-hmm. And by making the GDPR police, the ones who come in and say, you've had a breach, we're here to arrest you or punish you or fine you. All that means is people will do everything they can to avoid having a reportable breach or having anybody find out about a breach.
Well, is there anything that you think the FTC or a federal agency should be doing might substitute for a private right of action?
Yes, there are a number of things that they could be doing. And they don't necessarily have the full statutory authority to do this kind of stuff. But one of the problems they have as a regulated entity, a company that's trying to do the right thing, is that even adherence to the NIST guidelines or trying to adhere to the NIST guidelines is not sufficient to avoid liability. Most companies that have not had reportable data breaches simply have been lucky. You can have a company that has absolutely terrible security, but's never been breached. Why? They just got lucky. That company is deemed to be sort of compliant. Why? They've never had a breach. We focus far too much on breaches and far too little on privacy practices and on good privacy and good security rather than on breaches. So we need to change the focus. I think the FTC can do that. And I think the FTC should be able to assist companies in becoming compliant and not focus only on punishing them if they're not.
Well, they have. You know, I've credited the FTC with doing more to push companies to have enterprise security programs than anyone, because their consent decrees contained requirements that basically added up to an enterprise security program.
That's true.
It played a very big role in pushing that out, so they can.
Well, I mean, everybody should consider that they're under a consent decree right now. Because that's what these statutes effectively do. They require you to have these programs that are effective.
Well, some companies who are facing the CCPA and now the new Virginia law and the increasing onslaught of state laws probably do feel like that they are in that position.
You know, and I think this goes back to what Jerry was pointing out. What you really would rather have in this world is one comprehensive federal law that made sense, that was workable, that reduced the cost of compliance, and that actually focused on privacy and helping people understand what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. And also, you could give some carrots instead of sticks. One of the carrots you could say is, look, here are the NIST guidelines. If you can demonstrate a good faith effort to comply with it, and whatever the hell that means, you have immunity from liability. You don't have to do everything. You just have to do a decent job of it. And that is dictated by the nature of the information you've got. Obviously, if you've got nuclear secrets, you have to do more than if you've got information about, you know, painting houses.
These state laws that say, like New York, that are saying you have to have a security program. The financial regulators are now saying, we don't care if you comply with NIST or ISO or FFIEC or right, whatever, just find one and align with it. And they do list a few, but they don't say that's all inclusive.
Right, but the problem with that is this, is fundamentally this. A couple of two problems with that. The first one is that I had companies that say, hey, we need to have a written information security program that complies with Massachusetts law. And they say, well, yep, I went on the internet and I found one, downloaded it, global search and replace, where it says company, put in my company name. Yes, we have a written information security program. I mean, well, never underestimate the power of people to fake compliance.
Well, just for their listeners, that is not a security program that necessarily is tailored to...
Oh, you want us to follow the program? Well, you didn't say that. You said we had to have a program.
Listen, Jerry and I want to thank you. We want to thank you for this stimulating discussion. Jerry, do you have any comments at the end here to throw in?
Nothing more, except that we could go on because there is so much more to explore. And it's been really great to have you as a guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you both. And really, you know, they used to say on Hill Street Blues, hey, let's be careful out there.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks again, Mark.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. National Privacy Legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes.
or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.